Meeting is now being recorded.
Well, I would like to welcome everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to RPM, the subteam for U.S. Documents meeting on the 13th of June, 2018. On the call, we do have Kathy Kleinman, Zach Muscovich, Riven Barnett, Rebecca Tushnet, David McCauley, and John McElwain. We have apologies from Renee Fawson, from ICANN staff. We have Barry Cobb, Mary Wong, Julie Headland, Natalie Peregrine, and myself, Michelle DeSnyder. As a reminder, if you would please state your name before speaking for recording purposes. Thank you. I will turn the meeting over to Barry Cobb. Please begin.
Thank you very much, Michelle, and welcome everyone. Thank you for joining. Absent any objections, I'm hopeful that the group will allow me to run the call today for kind of just a glance down memory lane. Jay Scott was originally the sub-team chair for this group, and unfortunately he had to depart ways. Then secondarily, John McElwain kind of was the sub-team chair, but we weren't really sure whether we were going to continue on. But did lead us in some of the discussion at the last ICANN meeting. And Brian is kind of more de facto sub-team chair, but unfortunately he had a conflict and couldn't make it today. But I figure I'm probably going to be doing most of the talking today, so if you don't mind, then I will run it. Any objections to that?
Barry, this is Brian. No objection. I just wanted to let you know I'm here. Unfortunately, I'm only on my phone. I don't have a computer with me. I'm at a conference as well. So absolutely happy for you to take it from here.
Great. Thank you. All right. Our agenda today, again, is we're mostly just going to be running through some data that staff collected, as well as some data opportunities that we've got out of Rebecca's and her team's coding research. So before I begin, any issues with the agenda or any SOI updates? I'm assuming none and none. Very good. So I want to just quickly again walk down memory lane as to about how we got here. The last time this sub-team had met, right before the sub-team had presented to the greater working group its summary of findings, which are based basically on the consolidated URS document that we had worked on prior to, as the sub-team went and kind of documented possible data sources for each one of the questions, as they relate to the suggested topics like the complaint, the notice, the response. We identified certain data elements that might be useful in trying to answer some of the original charter questions or new questions as they came up. One of those, for example, was the element of appeals, which were 14 cases, staff was able to run a quick analysis on those 14 appeals and provide some data that was also equally shared back to the larger working group. There were still a few outstanding data sources and potential analysis that needed to be done. And one of the questions back to the larger working group is, you know, should the date document subteam continue forward, or should we do this within the working group? For the most part, the document subteam here is going to be going through those, but predominantly in all of that, I decided to go ahead and start putting some of the analysis together, and hence what we're presenting today. And mostly what we'll be talking about is the section of the response, which is mostly keyed off of Rebecca's coding matrix data, and then as well as some elements in the standard of proof and defenses. So to continue the quick walk down memory lane, what was great about Rebecca's coding exercise is that it helped us dive deeper than what we were able to just to glean from the metadata level that the providers have provided back. So what you see in the Adobe Connect room, again, is a split of the 821 cases, of which are coded by the outcome as well as the determination. And based on the way those were coded from the provider's site, we were starting to get a glimpse of which cases did the respondent actually reply or respond to the case. But that only took us so far. We can get into the details of when they responded within the 14-day window, whether or not they responded within the 6-month window, or whether there was an extension or not. And so fortunately, it was with the coding data that Rebecca's team did that we were able to drill down even further. And so now I'm on page 16 of the document in the Adobe Connect room. This was sent out with the agenda. Table 11, which is basically the URS case response analysis, and we can find a more fancy term for that down the road. Now, this note for everybody, this is a first-run draft. It really hasn't been peer-reviewed much, but that's the meeting right now. So of the 827 cases, basically this table is divided up first in what was the outcome of the URS cases. Basically, was the claim denied? Was it a default suspension? Was there a split decision, or was the case withdrawn, and with the last row being a total? And then it's further subdivided into if there was a response, did it occur within the 14 days? Second column, or really the third column, would be was there a response within 6 months, which is the de novo review? And then the third column, which is not applicable, pretty much means that there was no response found within any of the cases. So when we started to notice that within the claim denied of the determination that there were 59 cases where, you know, the claim was denied, that started to propose other questions, you know, by what reason was the claim denied if there was no response? And more importantly, if there was a response, what was the defense by which the respondent prevailed in that particular case? And we'll talk more about that in just a little bit. The second area, when we get into the cases where the name was suspension, either by default or by final, you know, we can see the breakout where there was a final determination, for example, of those 191 cases where there was a response filed and the domain eventually became suspended, it was coded correctly from the providers that it was a final determination, and there were 166 of those. Now, certainly this group can make a decision as to whether or not we need to peer into those a little bit further, but on the surface, we know that the complainant ultimately prevailed on all three elements of bad faith. Rebecca's coding research can help us do that. And when we talk about the analysis about the claims denied, I can kind of give you a preview of how that can be done. And then, of course, of those cases where the name was suspended and was ultimately because it was a default final or final determination, there were 26 cases where there was a response within 6 months, which are basically the de novo review. And if need be, we can go retrieve those case numbers and look at them in more detail. But I think if the group determines we need to dive deeper into those, that Rebecca's coding research will also shed some light on those so that we don't actually have to spend time looking at each case in detail again. So, in general, you know, some of the initial findings, basically of the 827 cases, which more or less takes us up to the end of 2017, you know, 27% of those cases contained a response to a URS case filing. 23% of the cases contained a response within the 14-day period, and another 13% of the cases where a response was filed within the 14-day period or the 6-month window, the claim was denied, which again is essentially the 22, where if you looked at the top left, claim denied, under the final determination, there was 22 that was filed within 14 days. To the right of that, there were 5 filed within the 6 months, or really 6 because one was a default and final. So that's kind of a general explanation of what the response analysis is about. And I don't think we need to make exact decisions today, but ultimately, we do have a better understanding now of where responses were occurring within the cases and what time frame they were. And the last comment before I open up the floor is based on the, not the practitioners, but the providers' survey results, we did find out that I believe there were 30 or so instances where an extension was requested, and that was based on feedback from forum, which ultimately shows that while there were extensions that were requested from at least that provider, none of the extensions at least appeared in any of the case information. Thus, that's why it wasn't extracted when Rebecca's team went through the coding exercise. So I'm going to stop here. Any questions or comments about this first run of in regards to the response analysis? Okay, I'm hearing and seeing none. And again, I'm sure this will take some time for you to sit in the corner with a cup of coffee and look at it and start to, you know, do a little head scratching and maybe ask other questions down the road. So most of today is really just the presentation of it. So based on what we have thus far, and when I was able to extract this data from Rebecca's research, the second area that this group was tasked, well, you know, let's go look at the 59 cases where the claim was denied. And immediately from this chart, as I mentioned a bit ago, 31 of those cases, the respondent didn't even respond. Thus, the claim was denied for one of the 3 elements, and they failed to prove that they met all 3 of those criteria. And then, of course, conversely, is where there was a response. There was either a final or a default final determination made based on those. So I'm going to stop sharing this document and get you to a new one. And so this is a deeper dive into those 59 cases where the claim was denied. And way over into the right of Rebecca's coding research, there are a few columns that ask specific questions. For example, if a response was filed, what defenses or facts were submitted to refute the bad faith allegation? Or conversely, if the complainant was unsuccessful, where did the complainant fail? So before I get into the details of this, I'm going to explain there's 2 avenues about how we can potentially get to some answers in analyzing about cases that where the claim was denied. What I just showed you is what I was able to pull out of Rebecca's coding research. but there's also a secondary analysis that her team performed. And I think we're both trying to get to the same way. The only difference is I, for one, am technology deprived and don't have the latest version of Microsoft Office. So some of the newer capabilities in creating pivot tables, I wasn't able to work with. And this is mostly why we've asked Rebecca to be on, so that she can maybe further explain what's going on here. So my version, again, was kind of just taking the raw data and creating my own pivot tables to compare and contrast that data to their versus an analysis that they performed with their tool set. And unfortunately, so I only provided a PDF version. I'm going to unsync this so that you can kind of scroll through it yourself. But this is a standard true-false analysis. I think there's a more formal word for this. But essentially, you line up a series of questions that you want to ask of the data. And if in the first instance it's false, then it raises the false flag and you move on to question two, which then can be divided up into false or true outcomes. And then as you continue to move down the steps into questions three and questions four, those can further be divided up between true and false elements. And then over on to the right, you have basically a total column that will quantify, in this case, the number of cases that meet that particular criteria. So, for example, here the first question was, the registered domain name is identical or confusingly similar to the mark, or which is the first element. Second element, of course, is does the registrant have no legitimate rights or interest to the domain? The third being the domain was registered or being used in bad faith. And then fourth, the examiner didn't provide detail to help answer any of the previous questions. And so as we move from left to right, we can start to further divide these true-false flags to get to the ultimate number. And I'll be honest that right there is kind of about where my analysis kind of stopped. But I'll try to provide one example, and then I'll turn it over to Rebecca if she'd like to provide some further insight into this. So first question was, the domain register is it identically or confusingly similar? And in in about 51 of the cases, ultimately, that was false, meaning that the domain that was presented as part of the case was not identical or confusingly similar to the mark. But further, to get down into understanding the other two elements, you know, did the examiner also go as far to say, you know, does the registrant have no legitimate right or interest to the domain? And if they have no legitimate right or interest to the domain, then the true flag becomes raised. And again, then further down, was it used in bad faith, false true flag, and you get the quantities out to the side. And so the only thing that I'll other say, and I before I turn it over to John, is that over to the right, there's also a breakout of the analysis. And unfortunately, based on some of the size of the questions, you may not be able to understand the text, but it's essentially it's broken out into four quadrants based on the four questions that were asked from left to the right. It's just kind of another summary view of looking or trying to analyze how these claims are denied. John, please go ahead.
Hey, thanks. John Ackling for the record. So I might have misunderstood this, but I just want to make sure the what I'm about to say is not correct. So this part of the analysis that went on is not a situation where Rebecca and her group determined in their own mind that a mark, even though found to be confusingly similar, they disagreed with that determination. Is that what the true and false means?
Thank you, John. My understanding, and Rebecca can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is when Alex and her team were actually coding the exercise, they were only reviewing the case and seeing the examiner did a lack of a better word, a pass-fail for each one of the three elements. They were not making a determination as to whether they thought the examiner was right or wrong. It was strictly what was only documented in the case. And, Rebecca, I saw your mic enabled, so I'll turn it over to you to clarify.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this is truly what did the examiner find. There are a couple points where, you know, we coded if there was anything that sort of raised eyebrows, but these columns are not that. These are purely based on what the examiner said, regardless of what anyone else might say. Thank you.
And Rebecca, John McLean, just to hop in, it might help folks understand then. So does that mean then if it simply was skipped? So these were situations where there was, if I remember right, a default, and it just wasn't mentioned by the panelist that was drafting the decision? Thanks.
Sorry, Rebecca Tashin. So these, if I understand this correctly, these are not sorted by default or not. So some of them are default, some of them have responses. The question is, so what happens if the examiner only says, like, the complaint fails on the bad faith element and therefore makes no other findings? So I believe we tried to capture that, but let me double check to make sure that my understanding is correct, and because I don't want to say something that turns out to be wrong. So let me double check and write you an answer. Have I correctly understood your question? Like, what happens if the examiner just talks about one of the elements and doesn't even mention the others?
I think the more precise question I'm getting at, and this is John McLean for the record, is what does true or false mean? Does it mean that true means there was an analysis provided by the panelist and false means there wasn't? That's what I'm kind of curious.
No. So with respect to one, say, true means that the examiner found that the domain name was identical or confusingly similar to the mark. You see, false means the examiner found that it wasn't. Does that help?
That helps tremendously. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Rebecca. And it took me a while to get over that hump as well about how these questions were answered. And I think I can, Rebecca, I think I can help you that for this side analysis that was a part of the overall spreadsheet from the coding merge. So if you look over it in the total of the right, there's 60 listed here. I think it should be 59. There may be a duplicate that's somehow appearing. But ultimately, this is the universe of cases where the claim was denied, but it does not make a distinction as to whether there was a response or not. And so I mostly wanted to show this again because I knew Rebecca needed to leave shortly so she could answer some questions and present it to you. But John, I had kind of the same when I was trying to answer these questions and peer into it better is why I came up with the secondary route, which I kind of gave you a quick brief viewing of it and wanted to look at it at a different light. So this is pivot tables that I created from the raw data that was presented in the coding exercise. And there are a couple of columns again, I don't believe Alex and her teammate were making judgments. It was strictly extracting from the case whether the examiner documented why the complainant or respondent prevailed on one of the three elements for whatever reason. So this first page here, and I'm gonna drive for a little bit so that you can follow along with what I'm talking about. So again, this first page is the universe of the 59 claims that were denied. And essentially I'm pulling from column Alpha Golf that asks the question first, if a response was filed, what defenses or facts were submitted to refute the bad faith allegations? And they have a set of 9 different codes that they would select based on what they found and extracted from each individual case by domain name. Now, this is rolled up by case, but they were essentially looking at the domain name level for most of the exercise. So again, down at the bottom here, we have a total of 59. And then the last row above the grand total is not applicable. That not applicable means that there was no response filed, and we'll talk about those in a second. For all the rest of these, which is the other 28 of the cases, there was some sort of tag trying to identify based off of procedures 5.7 through 5.9 to understand how the respondent prevailed in these cases. And I won't read through all of them, but, you know, whether there was a bona fide offering, the use of the domain name or fair use, or was it a generic or descriptive term, these were the defenses that were filed by the respondent. And in some cases, you know, way down at the bottom, number 8, the examiner didn't provide enough detail. So we'll go into these in a little bit more detail in a minute, but let's get the 31 cases where there was no response out of the way. So I'm going to move us on to page 2, and this is basically a different pivot table that's keying off of a different column, which is column Alpha Kilo. So if the complainant is unsuccessful, where did the complainant fail? And again, I filtered out all the cases where there was a response, which is kind of, again, the not applicable. We can see the total of 31. And essentially there's 5 different rows of why the complainant wasn't successful. The first one is that the complainant failed to prove that the mark was identical or confusingly similar. There were 5 of those. The registrant had no legitimate right or interest to the domain. They failed to prove that. There was 1 of those. There were 10 cases where both codes were inputted, the no legitimate right and interest, and they failed to prove that it was being used in bad faith. Then there were 13 cases where it just basically said that they failed to prove the bad faith use. And then again, 2, as we mentioned earlier, where the examiner didn't provide enough detail to make a determination. So, you know, based on how these 31 cases are keyed, if you find anything dissatisfactory about some of these numbers or a question that comes to your mind, then from there we can go pull those 10 cases, for example, and look at them in more detail if we feel that we need to or the working group needs to. So that's view number 1. I'm going to stop real quick. Any questions about how this is being presented thus far? I see in the chat, Griffin mentions the additional info 8, 9 and not applicable. So again, the not applicable is a code for that there was no response from the respondent. In terms of 8 and 9, 8 being the examiner did not provide enough detail. I can't say for certain, but it may be in some of those cases where information was cut and paste, or maybe there was a technical glitch and, you know, maybe the information the examiner documented didn't get published. It's just basically a category that was assigned by the coders when they couldn't make a clear extraction of how the respondent prevailed based on the procedures as defined in 5.7 through 5.9. And other, we'll get into that in the next page, then I'll explain that. So I have in the queue Brian and then David. Please go ahead, Brian. That Brian had to close Adobe. He'll
sorry,
go ahead, Brian.
I just wanted to say, I thought, for me, what I think would be helpful for us is, as you did on page 16 of your chart, was to produce percentage summaries of the timing issues with relation to the response. If that wouldn't be too much trouble, I think that may be useful for this category of the types of defenses under which respondents prevailed, just to kind of give us a different way to look at the numbers. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. I can give that a shot. It gets a little murky in that because there's multiple codes, it will require us to probably go back and, you know, how do we make a judgment as to if there's one that has the username name is bona fide and is a generic term, which one holds more weight to assign the percentage? As you'll see, they're very evenly distributed with only two that of, you know, making fair use of the domain without profiting, or the domain is generic and descriptive. Anyway, I'll take a look and try. It'll probably get a little fuzzy, but we'll take a look at that. David,
if it's too much confusion because there might be multiple defenses in a case, then it may be not worth it, but just wanted to raise the question. Thanks.
I'll for sure take a look. David, I see in the chat, I'll try zooming in once more. It gets a little hard to scroll around. And let me explain the next two slides, and then I'll give the group control to scroll around on their own. Okay, so again, we talked about the 31 cases where the complaint was unsuccessful, and then the other flip side is, all right, well, what are the other 28 cases, where the complainant failed and the claim was denied? The flip side is, what are the cases where a response was filed, and by what, by what defense did they prevail in? And again, this takes us back to column Alpha Gulf from Rebecca's research that, again, you know, what facts were submitted to refute the bad faith allegations. And again, this is just kind of a same picture as the one on page one, but the only thing I wanted to show you is because the first seven coding or codes are essentially extracted from procedures 5.7 through 5.9. I think number 8 is fairly obvious. The examiner didn't provide enough detail, so they need to, that's self-explanatory, but it's the other that probably piques the most interest. And there was an additional column, which would be column Alpha Hotel, I believe, that is kind of a free-form description. It appears they tried to code as much as possible, but they added additional details to it. And so I just wanted to provide, and I'm going to unsync this document now so you can move around and zoom in as much as you want. So these cases that were marked with other, whether there were multiple codes in the field, or whether other was the only field, this is some of the text that was extracted from the case by Alex and her team when they coded each of these cases. And, you know, so the, you know, the first two were exactly the same is because the complainant failed on the accusingly similar to a valid trademark prong. The examiner didn't specify what the respondent alleged as to respect to bad faith. One respondent proved evidence of use in the Arizona District Court. You know, and this is where the qualitative kind of information is extracted from the case. And I really just wanted to kind of cut and paste that for you because it was easier to see here than it is to see in the spreadsheet. I guess the question is how deep of a dive should the working group want to go on these others? Because I think the fundamental question here, and Mary can correct me if I'm wrong, is, you know, are there other defenses that potentially could be added to procedures 5.7 through 5.9 that should be documented to reaffirm the clear-cut cases of cyber swatting, or does the data just basically show that the defenses that are provided in the procedures now seem to be adequate and maybe there's no change necessary? So that's kind of where we're getting to here. So I'll stop there. Any questions or comments about this slice of analysis, with the exception of kind of an action item to try to put some maybe some percentages around some of these numbers. And I do agree that somehow we need to distill this down a little bit for import into the initial report at some point. Okay. Hearing and seeing none. Rebecca, if you want to leave, you're welcome to. That was the main part that I was hoping you could provide input on. The others, some of it does utilize your coding data as well, but we're that's a little bit more straightforward than when we're getting into this part of the analysis. So thank you for joining us. Okay, so we basically kind of started from. Oh, David, please go ahead.
Hey, Barry, it's David McCauley for the record. This is sort of related to what you just said as to where this information may lead us and what we might want to do. You know, a thought occurs to me, and maybe this has been stated before, but a thought occurs to me that one thing the group might want to do is create a judgment form that has checkboxes, even something as simple as that, with a field for further explanation. But it seems that we should at least ask of the examiners, you know, was this proven, was that proven, et cetera, et cetera. In a couple of these cases, we're flying completely blind. So it might be an idea. I think some courts actually do that, where they have a judgment form that, you know, the judge, whoever it is, examiner, has to tick certain boxes. It's as simple as it can be. It's either a yes, a no, or it wasn't determined, or whatever it is. Anyway, it's something, food for thought. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Kind of two components to respond to that. First, I think that, you know, there are other areas of Rebecca's coding exercise that gets into some more of that judgment form that you meant about. And so I think if we, you know, filtered out the view and moved left to right through the raw data, there are, you know, there are aspects of her data that talk about, you know, the trademark itself. And maybe we could start to better understand the correlation between the codes that they have listed there. The other alternative, because we're dealing with such a small universe, is if, you know, there is this judgment exercise, then maybe it does warrant going back through the actual cases on the provider site to get more detail. You know, so that's the other option. The secondary part, and I don't want to speak for others on the group, but I do recall resistance about treading too far about making subjective judgments on the examiner's decision, at least as so much as it was documented in the case, because we might not be privy to all of the evidence that was presented as well. So, but happy to proceed and certainly as directed, and thank you for the input. Okay, if no objections, so from the agenda, I think I'm kind of, at least for number two, where we're moving, we're working in reverse order. So one of the things that was also a part of Rebecca's data was the hope that we would be able to understand what the domain disposition was as a result of the cases filed based on the determinations. And so when her team first started out, I had already provided or extracted the raw data at the domain level of what data is presented from the provider's sites. I also did a query for who is information on those domains. And if you'll recall on our prior plenary call, the problem with that first extraction of the who is data was a last known record versus a most recent query. And so there is one column in Rebecca's coding research that has domain disposition, but because that first query was so outdated, I believe it really threw off the results. So what I wound up doing was going back to the drawing board, or really just starting from scratch and getting a fresh query of all the WHOIS records against the domain names. Now, this particular part of the analysis isn't identified in the documents subteam per se, so I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it today. Plus, you'll have difficulty reading it in the Adobe Connect room. But I'm just going to walk through the methodology and some of the findings that we get. So if you're not following along in Adobe Connect room, I'm on the staff compilation report updated on June 12th. The pages 1 through 10 are familiar to you because that's prior data that we presented as it relates to the URS cases that we extracted from the provider's site. And a lot of that, I suspect, will eventually go into our initial report. So I thought it best just to append this data to that same document as it evolves. So understanding the domain disposition of the URS cases, and it basically has a timestamp of May 2018. Let me walk through some of the methodology, and then we'll run through some of the numbers. So I think first and foremost, the group needs to understand that this is a snapshot of the data. Given the dynamic nature of the domain life cycle, domains are expiring, renewing, re-registering, new cases filed every day. And that dynamic nature will ever find a perfect fit, or maybe perhaps 5 years from now, if we were to run the analysis again on those cases up to 2017, we would get to a lot closer to a finite disposition of what ultimately happened to the domain. But a lot of this is in flight, so again, take it with a grain of salt that this is just what we see as of May 2018, and it could look completely different 6 weeks later. What I did here, again, was take all the domain names, which is 1,861, and ran a fresh WHOIS query using a third-party provider. Given some of the rate limiting and issues out there on port 43, there were about 400 domains that I had to go manually look up and extract the data from that. But essentially, the data from the WHOIS record was name servers, registrant, create date, expire date, whether it was registered or not, and put that into a spreadsheet. The tables up above, and I'll go ahead and give you control right now so you can scroll yourself. The first table on the left is a breakout by category by domain, so 1,861 domains, versus the table on the right is the same breakout, but that's by case. And there's a slight grain of salt with that, and how this is coded If there are multiple domains for a case, only the outcome or the disposition of one domain that is flagged as being a part of that case is what will prevail. Now, so most of the time, let's assume there was a case for 10 domains. Most of the time, those same 10 domains will follow the same domain life cycle. They were typically kind of registered on or around the same date. They all suspended at the same time. Maybe one or two of them were registered for a couple of years where others were only registered for one, but for the most part, they seem to follow the same cycle. So I'm not ultimately concerned about, how one domain may speak for the other nine of one particular case. For the most part, the disposition bucket still pretty much appeared to be the same. So the first division when looking at these charts is based on what came back from the Port 43 WHOIS query, and that is, was the domain registered or not? And that was a simple yes or no. So this table is first categorized by the determination. Was the claim denied? I'm sorry, by the outcome of the case. Was the claim denied? Was it a split decision? Was the domain suspended, or suspended final? And whether the case was withdrawn. And then it's further defined, or the second subcategory, was the domain registered, yes or no? And then the third, which is the smaller text, which is the disposition buckets or categories that I tried to assign to these. So continuing on with the methodology, essentially what I was doing in the spreadsheet was filtering out, okay, if a domain shows that the name servers are assigned to udrforum.com, I'm going to assign everything that domain is suspended. They're registered, yes, and I aligned it with the outcome of the case. Or secondarily, then I'd go in if the domain and the name servers look like they came from CSC or from Mark Monitor or other brand protection services. Then I'd classify them as being held under brand protection, registered, and then, of course, they're associated with their outcome from the case, so on and so forth. Down below in the methodology, there are different definitions for the disposition. I'm not going to go through those in detail, but suspended is pretty obvious. It's pointing to a suspended, or the website resolves to a suspension page. If it's not registered, it's not registered. Brand protection is meant to be kind of a bigger bucket. There are kind of subcategories under brand protection, and they seem big enough to not lump them all into one bucket, but the same rule kinds of applies that the trademark owner or the complainant, one way or another, recovered the domain through a variety of options that are available to them. So brand protection in general, by looking at the WHOIS, it was pretty obvious that CSC or Mark Monitor captured the name for the complainant, or the at least the trademark owner in the WHOIS. There were a handful of names where it was assigned to DPML, which is the domain protected marks list offered up by Donuts and Rightside, and I believe Minds and Machines has something. And then the name was reserved. It was kind of hard to tell exactly that, yes, the complainant trademark owner went to the registry and had it reserved. Registries implement their EPP responses differently, but ultimately, based on the return of the WHOIS query, nobody can register the name because it's blocked in EPP one way or another. And then there was kind of a fourth category, brand protection UDRP. I could see that, especially in the cases for the cases where the claim was denied, but they still showed up as being brand protected under Who Is. What it forced me to do is go search the domain and the UDRP cases, and sure enough, you could see that the claim was denied in URS, but they filed a UDRP and prevailed in the UDRP. I would take that category as kind of a grain of salt. I'm not 100% confident that I've got every one of them. I might work on that a little bit, but it was worthy of pulling it out and distinguishing it. The next few cases definitions, does not resolve, parked, or there was a website or forwards. Essentially, this gets more into the use of the domain, and those four kinds of categories, it was really, I couldn't tell from the Who Is record, and based on whether how the website or the resolution of the name occurred, it was difficult to find enough evidence that the complainant or trademark owner actually recovered the name. And so in some cases, what that ultimately might mean is that the domain, that the complainant prevailed in the case, the domain expired or was suspended, ultimately expired, and then it got re-registered. And if it looked like it got re-registered from a brand, then I sign it to brand protection. If I couldn't find evidence in that regard, and the Who Is record doesn't look like it associated to the brand, then I went to figure out exactly how the name was used. So in obvious cases, you could tell if it was parked, if it's website. A few of those were sketchy. I think fortunately I've got good antivirus on my machine. In some cases, the name forwards to the brand in question, but the Who Is record or nothing about the information in there could ultimately confirm that it was indeed the trademark owner. So essentially those four categories are non-brand protection related, but that it's difficult to be 100% sure with that. So what are some of the takeaways here? So based on through 2017, based on this snapshot, of the 827 cases, 1,861 domains, 20% or 28% of the cases or 59% of the domains remain suspended. Now, probably half of our data set is part of 2016 and all of 2017. A lot of those names are still registered. They're still suspended. So we're really not going to find out what the domain disposition is after the close of the URS and domain life cycle. 27% of the cases or 17% of the domains, the domain is no longer registered where most were suspended after the complainant prevailed in the URS case. And then 30% of the cases or 16% of the domains, the complainant chose for brand protection of one way or another. DPML, Reserve, their brand protection company picked it up for them, or they registered it for themselves in some of those cases. And the one footnote to this when you're looking at the quantity of domains is that one case had 457 domains, which was for Ashley Furniture, and another 202 domains in one case came from Cialis, all of which of those are still suspended. So the real hope here is kind of to float out, what's the course of play or across the environment here? What are, if somebody asks a question, are the bad guys re-registering the names? Yes, there are some. Why are brands choosing URS, and are they still able to capture the name even though they don't get the rights to the name like they do in UDRP? Well, there's definitely significant evidence that through a variety of channels, brand trademark owners are able to recover the name in a different avenue than what the UDRP provides. And then the third kind of big takeaway is that, you know, some brands are choosing not just to let the domain expire, and in a lot of cases that seems to work. Nobody seems to circle around, but there's still a handful of cases that, you know, a second person may come along and register that name. And I'll just make one last point before I open it up to the floor. Looking through this analysis, I only found one case where it looked like the same respondent re-registered the name after it expired. I don't have what case it is, but when I looked at the use of that domain, it didn't look like it was in a bad faith perspective, but that's not me for ultimately to make a determination. So I'll stop there. Any questions, concerns about this data? All right. Well, hearing and seeing none, so either you're stunned with numbers and dismay, or I'm doing a good job explaining it, or everybody's tired. So I'll move on to the next piece of analysis. Now, in doing the analysis of what I just talked about, something interesting kind of came out of the exercise, and I realized that there were a handful of domains, the same domain, but with multiple case filings. And I'll definitely leave it up to the group to spend time to digest this. So I'm just going to kind of talk about the structure and provide an example, and then this group can circle back about whether there needs to be any additional analysis here. So it was mostly in seeking out and reconciling the who is records that I got for the domain names that I started to realize I was getting duplicates. And then I was like, well, why am I getting duplicates? And so then I had to go back and cross-reference in the URS cases, and indeed I found multiple case filings for the same domain. Each one of these, there was two different cases filed for one domain name. And I believe there's 18 domains, so 36 cases ultimately were filed. Now there's some, basically column 2 is the case number. If you want to go look up any one of these, you'll be able to tell by the case number which the provider is, forum, and the other two. The case outcome slash determination. So whether the claim was denied, was it a final and the domain was suspended, or was it default and suspension for that particular case? The fourth column is the date by which the case was filed. I was running out of room, so I hope you don't mind that I included the actual date, but I included the month and year. That gets you into the same ballpark. And then finally, the last column, which is probably the most important, is understanding what happened. So as an example, I'll just use the first one, wolfram.ceo. In April 2014, the claim was denied. It looked like that there was a lack of evidence of any relationship between the complainant and the Wolfram Group LLC that was supplied to have been the owner of the trademark in question. So I think by the next case filing within the same month, they filed a new case, provided additional evidence, and the outcome, because it was so close together, it was indeed the same registrant slash respondent, and the case later got was appealed, where the complainant ultimately prevailed, and as of today, the domain is no longer registered. Or a secondary use case, or outcome out of this, is StarAlliance.flights. The first case filed in June 2014, it had a final suspension, meaning there was a response to that case, but the complainant ultimately prevailed. Then eventually the domain was suspended. I tried to be brief as possible, but it was suspended. Then it was deleted because the domain expired. And then March of 2016, it was re-registered by a different registrant in March of 2016. Given the quick time frame, there was some sort of monitoring solution going on to alert Star Alliance of the registration, and the outcome of that was a quicker default and the name was suspended. It went through suspension, it was then deleted, and now it was, and then it was registered new by Brand Protection Company. I think it was CSC or somebody like that. So anyway, that's kind of the idea of trying to compare both cases to see what was happening. I didn't put any takeaways or summary takeaways from here because I think they address three different ultimate buckets. Is whatever reason the first claim is denied, the brand came back and filed a new one and ultimately prevailed, or in some cases, for whatever reason, the case was withdrawn. I think there was one where ultimately the case was withdrawn, but then they went and filed a UDRP instead. So there's about maybe four or five different buckets here that kind of match to some of the dialogue or deliberations that have occurred on the plenary working group. And so, again, you know, look at these in closer detail when you get a chance, and we'll figure out how we can provide additional analysis if need be. So I'm going to stop there. Any questions or concerns about that table? Okay. So we've talked about the responses. We talked about the multiple URS cases filed in the same domain. Talked about the domain disposition. And then we talked about the cases where the complaint was denied, with a further breakdown of where there was a response and no response. So I think that pretty much takes us through the agenda. I have at least one action item to try to put some numbers around the claim denied cases, some percentage numbers for some quicker takeaways. And I guess with that, that's the end of the agenda. So any parting thoughts, comments, next steps? Should we, you know, could this be, when can this be presented to the larger working group? Should it be? Do you find it useful? Don't find it useful? Any feedback you have will be helpful. David, please go ahead.
I raised my hand, Barry. It's David McCauley speaking for the record, just to say thanks for this tremendous amount of work. And I'm not sure we're ready to present it to a larger group yet. I mean, what I'm struggling with, or where I want to get, is with all of this nitty-gritty detail, how does it prompt and help us answer the larger questions that would lead to reform of the URS? For instance, you know, what do we need to do with respect to an examiner's statement of the result, things like that, something I mentioned before. So, I find this all very useful and informative, in some cases puzzling, you know, that things shook out the way they did with some examiner's results. But so I'm wondering, and I'll ask you, you know, as you go through this, do larger questions or larger suggestions appear to you based on this? I think that's where we need to get to, is to start thinking, you know, where does all this information feed to on a larger scale, or on the ideas for reform? Thank you.
Thank you, David. I guess first and foremost is, you know, these are tools to help the working group when we circle back to ask these larger questions. And I do think that's an exercise that's probably shortly on the horizon. We've got, you know, by the time we have or three sub-teams and all of the data familiar with this, then we do need to circle back and ask these larger charter questions. And as we're trying to answer them, you know, it should be in the light. Well, should there be a change or no change to the rules or procedures as we understand them today? And if we still can't get to a quick answer, yes or no, we get to a quicker answer of no, then, you know, that's a good outcome, move along. If the working group is leaning towards an answer of yes, then perhaps maybe we need to use these tools to go isolate and document how this data supports that possible yes answer, and if need be, go deeper, a little bit deeper in the analysis of those cases. So I definitely agree that, that exercise needs to occur, and I won't make any opinions about if there are changes or no changes that need to be made. Kathy, please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me, Barry?
Loud and clear.
Okay, terrific. Hi, everybody. Sorry to be in and out today. In addition to changes, what comes to mind is also the word clarifications. Are there things that kind of we think the URS rules say, the procedural rules say, the substantive rules, and that we're not seeing, or that we're seeing from a number of examiners? They all, you know, a group seems to understand kind of what we think the rules mean, but a group doesn't. And so clarification might be, we might not be changing, we might be clarifying. I can't begin to tell you the speed that this stuff was all drafted in. So if there is room for clarification, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Kathy. So I think if anything, staff will get together early next week, and we'll put some more bells and whistles around some of this. Again, try to come up with some more summary extensions to help the working group digest this. And we'll get back to this sub-team next week with maybe some suggested steps forward. And I see Brian has raised his hand. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. What I did on my way here on the plane was to go through the list of topics to kind of refresh my memory where we were in this sub-team and in the working group generally. And I think, you know, the questions that David and Kathy have asked, I certainly have some takeaways from the data we have so far, also substantially based on our UDRP experience. And, of course, the URS was based on the UDRP. But what I found very useful for myself, and I wonder if it would be useful for us as a sub-team to go through, and this kind of feeds into the comment David made about we may not quite yet be ready to present something to the full working group, was to go through that table in the list of topics and just go through. So I'm just looking at it. For example, on A, the complaint, we identified three sources of data. And so I just jotted notes in the margins on, the first bullet point. We were waiting on the survey results from the providers, the same with the one from the practitioners. And then I just went through the chart and I identified places where we were waiting on data from survey, or we had some data, or we needed to take some of the information in Rebecca's research or otherwise and kind of pull it all together. So I wanted to offer that as a suggestion if others would find it useful for us to go back to this list of topics, run through it, see what we've accomplished so far, what we have data for, what we're waiting on data for, what we may still want data for, and then start to draw some rough conclusions ourselves and the hopes of bringing it to the full working group in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you, Brian. And Kathy, please go ahead.
Well, Barry, Do you want to respond, or does Mary want to respond to what Brian said? That's interesting. I'm going to follow up on a slightly different note.
I guess the response is staff will do whatever the group finds acceptable way forward. We're here to help and support it. What Brian said seems like a logical path, and I think that's somewhat in line with what David had mentioned as well in a prior comment. So please go ahead, Kathy.
Okay. So I wanted to suggest a variation. I know I'm you know, a visitor to this subteam. But let's say hypothetically we were supposed to be wrapping up the URS by the end of July. Oh, that's not a hypothetical. And so as we go through the checklist of the topics that Brian said, with the data that's been gathered, let's assume we don't have perfect data and that we're not going to be studying this and that we don't have the time to study much further. Is there a way to be very action-oriented now and say, looking at the topics, looking at the data we have, and would this make sense? What action, if any, is kind of bubbling up to the surface? If in general things are going well, what are we seeing that might not be the outliers? Examiner's decisions are one that we've been talking about, that it would be nice if all examiners, you know, gave us a basis for their decisions. Language is an issue that's coming to mind. And another working group that was talking this morning noticed that we're finding certain providers not sending out notice in all the forms that they're supposed to, that the rules say. So is there a way to kind of go quickly to more action-oriented, that if nothing's bothering us, it's probably okay, but what's bubbling up to the surface? Where are we seeing inconsistencies, something of concern to us, something that might need to be tweaked, fixed, changed, or clarified? Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. I don't want to speak for Brian, but it sounds like the approach that he had mentioned combined with your comments of as we go through each of those topics within the charter questions that we add those in the lens that you just provided. You know, so if everybody gets warm fuzzies, then, you know, we're good. We can document that we didn't see anything, any anomalies, and move on to the next section, and so forth. I think I do agree, you know, we're about as far as we can go in terms of collecting data. There may be a little bit more analysis that we need to do here and there, but, you know, to spend several months down the road of collecting more and more data, I'm not sure how much more value add that will be. So I do concur that, you know, it's time to return back to the questions that set us down this path and ask those actionable, should we change or should we not change types of questions in that light and document it and move forward.
Brian, I'm sorry, I'm not raising my hand, I'm just to jump in. I completely agree, and I don't see these as mutually exclusive. You know, Kathy, to your point, I mean, it was just sort of a suggestion, as Barry said. You know, we've got a lot of information, then let's start to pull it together. If we're seeing issues with some notices and languages, then that's what we identify. So it sounds to me like we're all more or less on the same page. We've come so far. Let's digest things and have a discussion about what we're seeing. Does that sound to everyone like more or less where we're at?
And Kathy, your hand's raised again. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with Brian. Would it make any sense as a first brainstorming step to just ask the group, and shoot me down if you don't like it, ask the group now whether anything from the current data has bubbled up, if there's anything kind of that, and any issues that appear to bear, you know, from what we've looked at already, that appear to bear review, like making an informal list, or is that for a future time? Thanks.
Uh, Thank you, Kathy. I'm not seeing or hearing any responses to that question directly. I think for sure one of the outcomes is death by data for today, so I do believe everybody needs a little bit more me time to kind of absorb it and tease out any questions that they may have. And in fact, maybe that's everyone's homework assignment. I don't believe we'll have time to meet next week, and then we've got ICANN meetings. So if the group does plan on coming back together, it won't happen till probably after July 4th. As I noted, I'll get together with staff early next week, and we'll do some internal brainstorming about next steps. But it does sound like in general that this group will probably reconvene once or twice more. And the homework assignment is to look through this data, ask yourselves questions. If you don't think you can answer from the data, please send them to me and I will peer in further to help try to answer that more peering question. We can document that, but review it in the context of the consolidated URS document that is posted in the Adobe Connect room, and then through the lens, you know, do you like the current state of play? Does something need to change? And document those thoughts, and more or less we can plan on getting back together after ICANN 62 to wrap this up. All right. I'm seeing and hearing nothing. Kathy, the checklist, I know that this document's posted somewhere in the wiki. We'll make sure that it's included in the notes, the link to it. It was also attached to the email for this agenda item. So with that, I'll go ahead and wrap this call up. Again, thank you everybody for attending. Sweet dreams on data. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Barry. Meeting has been adjourned. Thank you.